This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with another major development in the country's largest drug lab scandal. Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins says that her office could vacate up to tens of thousands more criminal convictions that were based on drug evidence tested at the now-closed Hinton Lab. WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker is reporting on this story. Deb joins us now. Deb, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Deb, DA Rollins is proposing to vacate any drug convictions based on results from the Hinton Lab from May 2003 to August 2012. Why that nine-year time window?
Well, that was the time period when two chemists worked at the Hinton Lab at the same time. Annie Ducan and Sonia Farrick, you may remember, both women were convicted on charges of tampering with the drug evidence they were supposed to be testing. Farrick's conviction, though, stemmed from her work at the state lab in Amherst. But both women worked at the Hinton Lab at one time. Farrick worked there before she went to Amherst. Rollins says what's needed is a more thorough review of all the drug certifications that came from the Hinton Lab while both women were working there. She calls the drug lab scandal systemic misconduct and a catastrophic failure of management that she says needs a complete review. So all the testing done at that lab during that time should be looked at. And we should point out that after both chemists were convicted, tens of thousands of criminal drug convictions were dismissed because of their misconduct.
And so now we're talking about more. Give us a sense of scale here, Deb. How many people might this affect?
Well, there's no precise number, but what Rollins' office says is that the Hinton Lab certified almost 83,000 drug samples for evidence during that time, and that was in Suffolk County. And the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, which has reviewed various challenges and calls for a way to deal with all of the cases in both labs, has vacated thousands of convictions based on the testing in Hinton Lab alone, about 8,000 from Hinton. So the remaining 74,000 drug certifications that Rollins is talking about from Suffolk County, she says her office is going to review all of those, and they could be part of what she says is a global resolution to deal with these cases once and for all, and thousands more convictions could be erased. But there's no exact number because one drug certification could have been, or several drug certifications could have been done for one case. So the exact number is unclear.
Got it. But it's a lot to review. So how does it work? Are they essentially starting, Deb, with the assumption that all the convictions must be vacated and then working backward from there as they review the cases? How are they going to do this?
Well, she says she's going to convene, Rollins says she's going to convene a summit next month with the defense bar to start this review, look at every affected case, all the drug certifications, and determine next steps. And she says any relief in what she's calling her Hinton Lab initiative is only for controlled substances convictions. And if someone was charged with something else along with drug use or possession or whatever the drug charges may have been, those charges would stand. This would only be the drug charges in a particular case. And then after that, they would look at expunging records if need be. It would be a very lengthy, complicated process.
So how are defense attorneys reacting to this?
Well, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, which was the agency really primarily involved in fighting with the SJC to try to get some sort of resolution for many of these cases that were based on evidence tested at the Hinton Lab and at the Amherst Lab, it says that it's pleased that Rollins has done this. Here is Matt Siegel, who's legal counsel for the ACLU of Massachusetts.
Certainly, it would have been our preference and the preference of the public defenders and our law firm partners for all of these cases to have been dismissed when we first started calling for that step in 2012. There's a saying about the arc of justice, and at this point, we're very glad that it seems to be bending in the right direction.
I think he's referring there to the, you know, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But regardless, also the State Criminal Defender Agency, the Committee for Public Counsel Services, released a statement after they heard about Rachel Rollins' initiative at the Hinton Lab. And it also said that it's pleased that this is happening and it hopes that other district attorneys will do the same.
So will they, Deb, do you think, will other DAs follow suit? And I guess I'm wondering if somehow this forces their hands if they have to now.
I don't think anyone necessarily has to. The district attorney for the Cape and Islands, Michael O'Keefe, who's also president of the Massachusetts District Attorneys Association, feels like this is old news. And he says what Rollins is doing is a publicity stunt. Let's listen.
We exhaustively examined all of these cases already by the thousands. And the cases that involved those two chemists, if they were the only reason that somebody was convicted of a crime, then those cases were already vacated.
I should point out, though, that Middlesex County District Attorney Marion Ryan has also said that she is reviewing some of the cases to make sure that any case affected by faulty forensic testing would be addressed by her office and corrected. But it's basically not clear if the other DAs will follow here, and certainly it seems as if District Attorney O'Keefe will definitely not.
And Deb, listening to you just there, it occurs to me, I guess I should ask, is this move by D.A. Rollins a surprise? Is this something that she telegraphed with previous moves, or is this step a surprise?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily a surprise. She's made two other moves to deal with some of these cases from the drug lab scandal, particularly at the Hinton lab. And she's looked at certainly people who entered, for example, guilty pleas before the drugs were tested. And then the tests came back when they were retested. The tests came back and found out that they weren't even illegal substances. So she did move to correct some of the convictions that were based on those guilty pleas before the testing was even done. So she has talked about this in the past, so it's not a huge surprise. But the stain of this scandal, of both of these scandals, really continues to darken the state's criminal justice system, and it's just ongoing. There are millions of dollars have been spent already to try to correct what happened at those two labs and the fallout from that. And there are three former assistant attorneys general facing discipline at the moment before the Board of Bar Overseers. So there's a lot still happening here, and I guess the story is still a big deal and continues to reverberate.
So that kind of gets at what I wanted to ask you next, which is how big of a deal is this? It sounds like maybe the scale on which Rollins is now doing this maybe is commensurate with the size and the scale of the scandal. Is that right, or is this really unprecedented?
I would say that it's fairly unprecedented, and we'll have to see what comes of it before we can say whether it's unprecedented. I think it's I think that it's a bold move, and once the summit is convened and there's a course of action laid out, I think we can find out and we'll exactly know if cases will be vacated, more cases than a significant number of them. Then I think it will be unprecedented. But we're talking, as you mentioned in the beginning, about the largest drug lab scandal in the history of this country. So all of this is unprecedented, and it was a real mess, and it continues to be one.
And that is WBUR senior correspondent Deborah Becker. Deb, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So this is a moment. For the first time ever in nearly 200 years of history, Boston has a mayor who is not a white man. And that is because former Boston City Council President Kim Janey, a daughter of Roxbury and a black woman, now is. Janey became acting mayor last night after former Mayor Marty Walsh was confirmed as the new U.S. Secretary of Labor. So what will a Mayor Janey mean for the city? What to expect from Mayor Janey's administration? Here to talk with us now about it is Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, mayoral candidate in 2017, and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Tito, welcome. Thanks for joining us to talk about this.
Thank you. The weather is not only nice, but this is there's a black woman mayor in the air.
So let's talk about that, Tito. I've been so interested to just hear you react today. I mean, we've known this was likely at least coming for a while. I mean, it's been weeks since President Biden said that he was, you know, nominating Marty Walsh as labor secretary. But now it's really here. You kind of chuckled there, like almost, you know, gleefully. How are you feeling about this today? Reflect on it a little.
This day means so much to me. I spent a great chunk of my life really fighting for opportunity and equity for everybody in Boston and to have a government that looks like the city of Boston. And so today, when I woke up this morning at 3 o'clock, it felt like kind of like Christmas to me. I feel that today is a major step for our city. When I think about, you know, my run and the issues that I was pushing at the time, they are now kind of ubiquitous across the board for every single candidate. And I was in many ways looked at a little bit like I was crazy when I was saying some of the things that I was saying. And so I'm really happy that Mayor Janey is putting the issues of opportunity and real equity, beginning with COVID-19, at the front of the agenda. And that this, I hope, is a turning point for the city of Boston, and that we are able to come together in ways that we haven't been in the past. So it is a wonderful, wonderful day. Lastly, Tiziana, for me, I have a Black woman mayor, Kim Janey. I have a Black woman congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley.
That's all right.
And I have a Black woman DA, Rachel Rollins. It is a wonderful day in my neighborhood.
That is fantastic to hear you sound excited about something that's been important to you. Tito, you used the phrase opportunity and equity a couple of times there. So let's talk about what that looks like. So right now, Janey will be mayor through the end of 2021. We'll look ahead later. So over the next 9 months, how do you see her focus and her lived experience playing out on a practical basis? What current policy issues are going to rise to the top, and how will she lead differently than Mayor Walsh for the last 7 years?
Yeah. So I think the issue of education is a absolutely an important one. This is going to be about getting our young people back in our schools in a safe manner, making sure that our teachers are protected and that they're vaccinated. In addition, getting as much as we can the facilities ready. We know that 2/3 of the schools in the city of Boston are built before 1945. We have a lot of work to do. When people were talking about HVAC, most Boston public schools have H, which is heat. They don't have the ventilation and AC. So there's a lot of work there. The issue of what's going to happen relative to a school committee, whether it be elected or not elected, early education is an issue. But I think one of the other issues that is absolutely critical is getting the Boston economy rolling again, which definitely starts with many of our restaurants, as well as eateries across the city of Boston, and opening those doors of opportunity. And recently, this issue of contracting in the city of Boston, I want to give props to BECMA, Amplify Latinx, and other groups the Lawyers for Civil Rights, who have put forward this issue that the city of Boston has spent $2.1 billion in the last 7 years, and only 1.2% of that have gone to Black and Latinos. That is unacceptable, and it has to actually change. So I believe that these issues, as well as those issues of housing, that many people haven't been able to pay their rent in a year. What are we going to do for those folks? And also the issue of the recovery community and what's happening along the Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard weigh heavy on the minds and hearts of people in the city of Boston.
And just to back up for a second, for our listeners, BECMA is the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. We actually had Shagun Idowu from BECMA on last week, and I think you're referring to the federal complaint that those organizations filed about the contracting numbers in Boston. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
All right, so I want to play a little sound from you. This morning, Acting Mayor Janey described her focus now to WBUR's Bob Oaks on Morning Edition. I want to play that for you, Tito. Here she is.
It's very, very important that as we recover, reopen, and renew, and that is the framework that I am using for the work that is ahead, that we do so with intentionality around closing the many gaps that we see.
So I want to be clear here. Mayor Janey, as acting mayor, serves through 2021. There will be an election for mayor in November. There are five candidates for that election. As of right now, Kim Janey is not one of those candidates. But in listening to that, Tito, and in listening to what you just laid out, you know, equity and opportunity, closing those gaps, as Mayor Janey just said, those are long-term endeavors. So two parts here. Part one, certainly this does not sound like somebody who intends to be a caretaker mayor during the time that she is acting mayor. This sounds like she's got an agenda. She's going to do as much of it as she can over the next 9 months. Is that right? And is that because we're in a pandemic, or is that just about her leadership approach?
If you know Councilor President Mayor Kim Janey, you know she is not going to be a caretaker mayor. That is, she will be far from that. She will be an activist mayor. Someone who is, you know, when we look back at her history on the council, in the cannabis industry, the reason why we have now have equitable access to licenses in the city of Boston is because, primarily because of Kim Janey's legislation, which says out of the 52 licenses in the city of Boston, 26 will go to people who are equity applicants and 26 will go to the broader community. She did that. And so that's precedent. And I believe that she will continue to lead with an eye for closing gaps, be it around the $247,500 that white families are worth versus the $8 that black families are worth and $0 that Dominican families are worth in the city of Boston, to the opportunity gaps. And she served a lot of time in the education space and has advocated in that space. So she is going to not just sit on the city. She's going to get in the car and drive it.
So then when I said that she, I implied that she had not yet said either way. And that is true. Well, she has not said she's running and she's not said she's not running. You chuckled. You ran for mayor in 2017. Do you think she should run? And if she does decide to run, what advice would you give her?
I think Madam Mayor has an amazing opportunity to run and to set out what she would like to do for the city. The advice that I would give her is to always turn to the people. There are many folks who have a lot of dough, and there are many groups who will pull you in a lot of ways, but the people will never lead you wrong. I also would say not only to her, but also to the broader community. I don't want it to be that there's a double standard as a woman of color, that she has to be perfect, and that you know, white males don't. I think we should give her an opportunity to step forward and lead, and to do what she has done in the rest of her life, is taken many of the challenges and made them triumphs. And so I think she would actually be a great, she is going to be a great leader in the seat that she's in, and she will be a great leader in whatever seat that she chooses to run in.
So in our last minute or so, Tito, she ran for and filled the vacancy that you created in the city council when you ran against Marty Walsh in 2017. Walsh served since January 2014 until yesterday. What do you make of his legacy, of his time steering the city?
Listen, Marty and I have had many very public head bumping. He has a good heart. I think there's a lot of things that we still need to do. The closure of the bridge to Long Island, I still think is a stain on the city, and that has to be repaired. I don't believe it should have been closed or taken down. I also think we have a lot to do relative to the issue of education and closing persistent and real achievement gaps in our city. And this issue around the wealth gap in the city of Boston is still pronounced, profound, and persistent. And so I think we have a lot of work to do in this city. And it gives me great pleasure to have a Black woman stepping up to do this work on this historic day. And I know a lot of others count the date to 200 and some odd years. I look at it, Boston was founded in 1630. That's the first time we've had a black woman as a leader in that role since 1630. Our city is facing a future and days ahead of us that are much better than the days behind us.
That is Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, mayoral candidate in 2017, and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Tito, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Stay tuned. We are going to go to a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about this, how this pandemic has changed your life, your relationships. We'll take your calls, 800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. That's after the break. This is Radio Boston. For the rest of the show today, we want to talk about how this pandemic has changed your life and your relationships, and how you feel about those changes. We'll be taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255 in just a little bit. But we want to do a check-in first, because pandemic life is just going to keep going until enough of us are vaccinated and safe. And news about the likelihood of those two things just keeps coming at us. So we want to do a quick check-in on the variants and vaccines, including the latest news over the last 12 to 24 hours about yet-to-be U.S.-approved AstraZeneca's vaccine. So we have a guest joining us to do that, Dr. Davidson Hamer. He is a professor of infectious diseases and medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, also a professor at Boston University School of Public Health. Dr. Hamer, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Hamer, I want to start with this complicated picture. So yesterday, the Commonwealth entered stage four of reopening. And while overall numbers remain low and that reopening is happening, in the last week, the average case counts have risen and more Massachusetts towns have entered the red. Meanwhile, we're seeing other countries, France, Germany, Italy, re-enter lockdown. We heard news out of New Jersey today of a surge that's concerning there. Are we at risk right now of another surge here in the Commonwealth?
That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I think we are not completely in a safe place yet. I think part of what's happening in at least in Massachusetts and potentially several other states in the U.S. is rapid spread of the B.1.1.7 variant, the UK, so-called UK variant. And that appears to be more transmissible. And actually, there are two studies from the UK suggesting that it's associated with a higher risk of severe disease and death. And that may be happening concurrent with our gradual rolling out of the vaccine. And, you know, hopefully the vaccine does cover this strain. It creates immunity that eliminates the strain. But we need to move faster with the vaccination before this catches up to us.
I don't mean to make light of this, but I am imagining in my mind one of those old carnival tabletop games with the horses on tracks that are running against each other, the little metal ones. And I feel like what I'm hearing you say is that the vaccination rate is running against the spread of the variants. Is that right?
I mean, that may be the case. Again, you know, without sequencing, you know, a large number of isolates from infected people, it's hard to know how widespread the different variants are. And there are other variants of concern. I mean, at least the preliminary data that has been generated in Massachusetts and also across the country suggests that B.1.1.7 has been spreading fairly widely. But there are other variants. There's the P1 from Brazil, and there's the South African strain, and there's a new strain from California. So there's a lot that requires monitoring. And, you know, if we have more systematic sequencing of positive samples being done, we'll have a better understanding of which of these strains are becoming predominant. But you're right, it is sort of a race to get the vaccine out before they spread too widely. And the other benefit, if we get a large proportion of people immunized, there's less transmission of virus, there's less virus present, and it has fewer opportunities to mutate. And that'll sort of even help eliminate the likelihood of new strains developing.
So what I take out of that is, yes, there's a bit of a race, but also there's a lot we still don't know, and it's still quite complex. And then I feel like we've got now some whiplash here. So AstraZeneca, not approved for emergency use here in the United States, being used in Europe. So to briefly recap for our listeners, earlier this month, due to concerns about blood clotting, some countries in Europe stopped deploying it. The EU then said, that's not appropriate. It is safe. And then yesterday, AstraZeneca reported promising results from its U.S. trial because, of course, it wants to be in the process of getting approved for emergency use here, authorized for emergency use. But then overnight, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases said that the data they presented yesterday may have been based on outdated and incomplete information. So lots going on there. What do you want people to take away from the moment about the AstraZeneca vaccine and where we are in this kind of unfolding saga?
The AstraZeneca vaccine story is a complicated one. I mean, I think they've made several missteps over the course of the last several months. I mean, the first one had to do with their design of the initial trial and the dosing schedules that they used in that. And then the second was the much more recent one with clotting, which is a complicated story that's very nuanced. I mean, they're probably the normal levels of clotting are not above what you would expect to see in a population at any one point in time. But there's a very rare form of a cerebral thrombosis that's occurred that we don't know if it's clearly associated with the vaccine. It's just happened a few more times than one would anticipate. So it definitely merits further investigation, but it's very rare. And it may not necessarily be due to the vaccine. And now this issue with the release of data, which apparently the Data Safety Monitoring Board, which is a group that's put together external to the trial to monitor for safety purposes, they were the ones that raised the red flag on this. And usually the DSMB or the Data Safety Monitoring Board works very closely with the company to sort out issues. And so this is a very unusual situation. And I think in the end, it's going to work out that, you know, that this will prove to be an effective vaccine for preventing symptomatic infection. And all the evidence suggests that it's very effective in preventing severe disease and hospitalization. And that's the most important component. But it really is unfortunate that there have been these challenges that have arisen.
Dr. Hamer, concerned then that the drama, despite the outcome that you just laid out that you're anticipating, that it's going to undermine public sense of safety, public confidence? I mean, we're already having lots of conversation about vaccine hesitancy here.
I mean, it may do that, but the reality is that we are using the Moderna vaccine, the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine, and now the Janssen, Johnson & Johnson vaccine. There have been no issues with those vaccines. You know, they cause some short-term side effects, and then people recover, and it looks like they induce, you know, very good protective immune response against both symptomatic infection and, most importantly, severe disease and hospitalization. So we have three, you know, effective, safe vaccines on the market in the U.S. already. You know, having a fourth would be great, but we need to sort of sort through some of these questions that have arisen.
So in just a minute, we're going to open the phones, turn to a couple of other guests, and talk about how pandemic life has changed us and our relationships and what of that we want to keep and what of that we want to change. But we can't make a lot of changes until we're on the other side of this, whatever that is. And so I guess, are we winning or losing our battle to contain the virus and get on the other side of it?
I think overall we're winning, but there clearly have been challenges. I mean, if you look at Israel, which has done one of the best sort of jobs in the world in terms of scaling up vaccines to their population, you know, their rates of hospitalization and new cases have plummeted. And I think that, you know, as Biden's plan and the CDC all work together to increase availability of vaccine at the state level, states figure out how best to deliver it. People need to be willing to accept the vaccines. And again, you know, they are effective and the evidence thus far suggests they're safe. If we get a high level of coverage of the vaccines, you know, I think we will have very little disease being transmitted. We can get closer to being back to normal.
All right. That is Dr. Davidson Hamer of both the Boston University School of Medicine and the Boston University School of Public Health. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right. Take care.
So we will open the phones now. We want to spend the rest of the hour talking with you about how the pandemic has shaped the way you live, your relationships, and how you feel about those changes. What do you want to keep? from your COVID-19 adjustments? What do you want to lose from those adjustments? And have you grown closer to the people in your life, further apart? Maybe you've been dating. How has that been? Have certain life events happened for you sooner than they normally would? Maybe moving in together, planning a family, trying to buy a house. And what about personality and personally? Are there habits, traits you've picked up that you want to keep or let go of? New hobby, something that gets you excited now that didn't before. We want to hear about all of it. 800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet. We have two really fun guests to join us for this. Meredith Goldstein runs the Boston Globe's Love Letters advice column and podcast. And comedian Bethany Van Delf also hosts the 10 News and Artisan Comedy and is a co-host of Parental Logic on Nova/PBS. Bethany, Meredith, welcome. Glad to have you.
Hello. Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Hey, great to have you both. So, Bethany, what is one thing that has changed in your pandemic life, and is it a keeper or one that you want to shed?
Oh, God. Everything has changed. I would like to shed co-parenting 24/7. Yeah, I'd like
to
get rid of
that. Say a little more about that. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, now, the co-parenting or the 24/7?
The 24/7. Okay. So my husband and I, we're fine. We're together. We're living, married with our kids. And in the before times, he worked, you know, a kind of office hours, like 9 to 5-ish. And he got home by 6 and then would kind of, you know, tap out and I'd leave to go do shows in the evening. And on the weekends, we were like the best together parents in the whole world. This 24/7 of parenting at the same time, like, you know, he'll come down in the morning. I got the kids all set up for remote learning. He comes down for his coffee and then he starts barking out orders to the kids. And I'm like, we got this. We're okay. We're all right. Give hugs and kisses, grab your coffee, go back upstairs to the bedroom office, and we got this.
So, Meredith, so first, Bethany, I want to say my husband and I joke that when things are going well together, we make one really good parent. When it's really going right, never two, just one together. Meredith, I noticed that the first thing Bethany went to had something to do with a relationship. And I know that's something that you've been thinking about during this pandemic. So maybe you just want to pick it up from there.
Well, first of all, this is a delight because I'm a big fan of Bethany. So this is such a delight to be here. But I will say that as an advice columnist, what a year. I mean, the problem's completely changed. Every problem about relationships has a COVID lens. And I would just say that, you know, in the very beginning of the pandemic, people would call me because I live alone and they would say, are you okay? But you're alone. And I would sort of say, well, I've got my TV and my snacks, and I felt, you know, very grateful. But I think, you know, couples who had a routine, you know, a lot of couples would say, we're not good at this. This is hard. We're not good at this. And I would say, you're not supposed to be good at this. Who's supposed to be good at this? So I think there's going to be a lot of healing that has to do just about realizing the year that couples went through. You know, I recently interviewed a chaplain who likened it to telling a bunch of athletes to switch positions, you know, that people are doing jobs they never did. And that, you know, rang very true to me. And I think, you know, on the flip side of it, I'm also seeing so many couples who started dating during this time. And what a fascinating study, because they have had all of this time to appreciate each other, to build a foundation, to bubble together, to be in a pod together. And yet they have never been at a party together. Maybe they've never been stuck in traffic together. So for them, entering the world in the after times, which, you know, hopefully we're getting to, is going to be a shock in a very different way.
So I'm going to go to the phones here. And again, listeners, we invite you into this conversation. What has changed for you in your personal practices, your relationships, who you live with, how you live together? Bring it all. 800-423-8255 is the number to call. Let's turn to Catherine in Marlboro. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi. My husband and I have created a way that people can sing together when nobody's allowed to sing together indoors. We do something called the driveway choir that literally started in our driveway. And I feel like we have met so many people in the choral world. We've worked with a lot of different choral directors and singers. We've had like 700 people come to different events that we've done. And I feel like we're working together in a way that we never were able to before with our different careers. So that's been really fun.
How does it actually work, Catherine? So what am I picturing in your driveway? How does this work?
Well, we hand everyone a wireless microphone and we tell them an FM radio frequency that's not used that we that everybody tunes to so that they can hear the mix of the sounds of all of the singers who are in their little bubble. And so we have, you know, 25 or 30 people all singing in their own cars, but we mix them on a mixer and it sounds like a chorus. We've even
Catherine,
gone as far as to have like 100 people sing the Messiah in December. So that was fun.
I'm so glad you called them. I know, right, Catherine? Awesome. Thank you for calling and telling us about that. So, Bethany, do you have a top that, Bethany? Do you have anything as good as that that you've started doing? And if not, what is something that you've started doing that you kind of like and might even want to keep doing once we finally get to some other side of new normal?
I feel like I'm still in the trauma. Like it's too soon to be able to answer that question. No, I love that idea of the choral. I want to stop researching places to donate outgrown kids' clothes, and I would like to. So I just want to change this when the pandemic's over. I want to be a little bit more free about my donating. Like, I want to be able to put some board books and some baby clothes and some coats in the same bag and feel confident dropping it off at one place. So I think this is more like a growth thing. I hope that I grow into this new role post-pandemic in the aftertimes.
When you say feel confident, what do you mean by that? Feel confident dropping off
right
it off
now,
in one place.
Well, right now, I research the best place for each item. And so I have 30 bags going at all times.
Oh my gosh, Bethany.
Like,
oh my gosh.
Who needs coats? This is, Meredith, is this us trying to stay married? Is you go work on the donations, Bethany, and I'll take care of this leaky faucet. I don't know. I have too much research going on about who needs what the most. And so 30 donation bags going at all times. So I have a bag of shoes, lightly worn shoes. And then I have a bag of shoes that are too worn for reuse, but they could be recycled for parts, rubber materials. I have bags of school uniforms. I have bags of underwear, socks, things like that, that can't be, reused, but can also be recycled in a fabric place.
Yeah.
I want to stop this behavior. I want to grow out.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore. That's pretty hardcore. Meredith, so Bethany is just being wonderful, letting us into her world and sort of her journey.
I'm impressed and astounded. I mean, there are a lot of, maybe it's easier as a single person to say what I want to keep, but I, in terms of my routine, but I hope that, this idea of being able to say no and to just have an evening at home, that's something I would like to keep, just like a better balance. That I also think that for people who are dating, this idea that everything moved slower, right? That you could have a video, a FaceTime date before a real date, and that you could take your time. I hope that that remains, because I think the most common problem I heard before this was dating fatigue from people. They were just sick of swiping and going, it all moved so quickly that they could never really rest in a moment. And I hope the world retains that, that feeling of, I don't have to do this as quickly as possible because it's not about quantity or missing out. But I would say this, and I actually fear saying it because I fear I might be taken up on it too much. For us people who are single, who don't have children, who, I think many of us have felt very frustrated that we haven't been able to help our friends who may be thoughtfully putting different clothing into bags to donate them, that we haven't been able to help, And I would just say that, like, this has reminded me that all of us, no matter how we're partnered or what children we have or don't, we're all supposed to exist in some sort of community. And I have told a few friends, look, when this is over, I'm supposed to help you babysit. And you're supposed to help me feel less alone. And I hope that we get to a place where we remember to call on each other and remember that, it's not a burden. And if it is, we'll say so. But I want to embrace all that we can do after this for each other, because I will say that parents, no matter what resources you have, this is an entirely different experience for you than it is for other people. Everyone has had a difficult time in different ways, but it is just this very frustrating thing to think, oh, if only I could do a little bit more. And I think soon we will. But just the sort of boundaries of, I don't have to be everywhere all at once. And my final soapbox perch that I will stand on is that I think that there's been a new respect for accessibility in the world. This idea that we can click on a link and see something, go to a party, go to a book reading, go to a concert without having to drive into the city and park, without having to navigate streets. For some people, that was always a barrier. And what's strange is that in the last year, there's been an accessibility that there hasn't been. So I've talked to a lot of venues about, you know, how can we keep this going? Some people want to be there in person and some people just can't be. So I hope that sticks around too.
A lot of optimism there. I want to go back to the phones. No, Bethany, did you have something else you want to say there before I go back to the phones?
I absolutely agree with Meredith. And that is something that I would love to keep is, like you say, the idea of accessibility, being able to, you know, take, quote unquote, take the kids to the Louvre on a computer or watch a ballet, but also to stay in touch with family, you know, without this idea that we have to find, you know, we have to travel to each other or, you know, we have to invite big groups of people for milestone birthdays. We celebrated a couple of milestone birthdays in this pandemic. And it was so beautiful to see people from all over the world celebrating. And, you know, we livened it up with little videos and we did, you know, picture presentations and everything. So that was definitely those celebrations were highlights of the pandemic. I hope we don't let that go so that we are able to stay together in ways other than traveling or things that are cost prohibitive, like traveling.
Let's go back to the phones here. 800-423-8255 to join this conversation about what has changed in your pandemic life, your pandemic relationships, and how you feel about those changes. We've got Cindy on the line from Nashua up in New Hampshire. Cindy, welcome.
Hey. Hi, Tiziana. Can you hear
Jump
me?
Jump on in. I can. Jump Hi. On in. Tell us your story.
Oh, well, I wanted to say that my relationship actually improved during the pandemic. I am a divorced woman with a grown child, and I had been seeing a man also divorced with children. And before the pandemic, we sort of struggled. You know, he had his space in his house and I had mine, and we'd see each other when we could for almost 10 years. And I ended up living with my elderly parents, who were in their 80s. And then when the pandemic hit, I had to leave them because I couldn't safely be with them. And so I came and lived with him, and now we're engaged. So it turned out well for us being together, sort of forced to be together because I couldn't stay with my parents. And so things worked out well. We're planning a wedding in October.
Congratulations, Cindy. That's great. It is heartwarming to hear these moments like Cindy's in Nashua, right, where we've adapted to the pandemic and the necessities of it, even when they were unhappy necessities like having to move away from parents, and found joy in that. And the two of you, Meredith, Bethany, you've been joyful. I do also want to note that we've had some adaptations that have come out of pain, loss, you know, loss of income, loss of family members, adaptations based in trauma. How are we going to crawl our way out of those as we find our way out of the pandemic as well? As Meredith, maybe I'll start with you just in what you're hearing from readers and people who write to you.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we know is that we've all experienced this together. So I think there's going to be a collective, I hope there's a collective understanding and empathy of everyone coming out of this with different losses. You know, just, I always relate this back to dating and romance because of the advice column, but, you know, many people lost jobs and all of a sudden it meant a different thing. If you were on a dating site and said you were unemployed, like, well, you know, join the club, right? There was a better empathetic look at all of this, all of the places we can be in life. And when you stretch that out to encompass grief, I think, you know, it's so interesting. I think that people are much more likely to say nowadays, how are you? And really mean, you know, holistically, how are you? And I think, you know, again, not to be too optimistic, but I think we're just going to have to keep reminding ourselves that we don't know what the person next to us experienced over the past year. And I hope that kindness comes out of that and listening comes out of that. One of the positives of this has been that labor that had been invisible is now visible. But I think, you know, on Zoom calls, when children are in a room, you know, we see these things, you know, and loss has been very visible too. So I'm hoping that it turns us into a culture that makes space for that and truly pays attention to it.
Bethany, I've thought about that too. For you as a comedian, how do you accompany people in, you know, with your work, with humor? Often we turn to that when we're hurting. And what has that been like?
It's been really, people have been so open and so ready for any kind of laugh. Also, they've been way more open to and appreciative of, you know, humor being more reality-based, you know, rather than just being silly, but being able to talk about things that are really tough to talk about and infusing it with humor. You know, during the protests after George Floyd's murder, it was hard for me and a lot of comedians to figure out how to be funny around those times. And I think finding that place where there is funny is one thing. And then the audiences on Zoom and Instagram Live and like all these strange ways we performed virtually, people being really open to it and embracing it and accepting it. Like, yeah, because everyone is going through this, like Meredith said, the whole world is going through this at the same time. Where I might joke about my anxiety or depression, some of the people in the audience might not have gone through that, or they might not, you know, have experience with it. Some people don't even believe that it's real. So you have this mix of people and their like level of reception to hear these jokes. But everyone has gone through this now. Everyone watched the protests. Whatever you're feeling about it is, everybody's watched these things. And so now, as comedians, we're able to use this material to find funniness in maybe the way we thought about it, or the things that you know we would think would be the most pressing idea on our minds during these times, but it ends up being something else. Like, I have to have a toaster. If I have to be in lockdown, I've got to have a toaster, or something like that. I think that that happens. I think that what audiences are, you know, more accepting of our topics, our material, what our material is thinking about and talking about, I think that's going to change a lot. And I've watched it change over the year. And I hope that's something that stays, because I do think that we run from loss, we run from grief, we run from pain. And a lot of comedians, that's, you know, we're pulling from that. So.
And on that note, that is comedian Bethany Van Delft, who's also the host of the 10 News and Artisanal Comedy and co-host of Parental Logic on Nova PBS, as well as Meredith Goldstein, who runs the Boston Globe's Love Letters Advice column and podcast. Thank you so much. What a joy to have both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. This is awesome.
Listeners, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman. We've got help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening and calling. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.